edition of the debate. For me, Mikhail Vitarvayis, goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa al-hayyul qayyum. لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. US President Donald Trump again accuses Democrats of vote fraud and election theft, saying his opponents are trying to rig the election. Two prominent Republican senators attack the legitimacy of the presidential vote results, while several others express frustration with President Trump's allegations of vote fraud. Also ahead, supporters of President Trump and his Democratic opponent Joe Biden hold a second day of rival protests in several U.S. cities over the election vote count. We're live from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. U.S. President Donald Trump has once again hurled accusations at Democrats, claiming they are engineering the presidential election.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on, and this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election. And we can't let that happen. Detroit and Philadelphia, known as two of the most corrupt political places anywhere in our country, easily cannot be responsible for...
Trump added that if, quote, legal votes are counted, he will easily win the presidential race. He once again lashed out at the mail-in voting system, calling it a one-sided method that benefits Democrats. Trump's campaign filed lawsuits to halt vote counting in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, while claiming voter irregularities in Georgia. State judges in Georgia and Michigan, however, have rejected the suit, citing a lack of evidence. In the meantime, Democratic candidate Joe Biden expressed confidence that he will be elected as the next U.S. president after the vote counting process ends.
We have no doubt that when the count is finished, Senator Harris and I will be declared the winners. So, I ask everyone to stay calm. All the people to stay calm. The process is working. The count is being completed. And we'll know very soon So thank you all for your...
The Democratic candidate stressed that each ballot must be counted. The race is tight in Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Biden needs only 6 more electoral votes to secure the 270 required to win the nail-biter race. Trump has so far won 214. Final results can take days to be announced, as counting mail-in ballots is said to be a time-taking process. Senator Mitt Romney said counting every vote is at the heart of democracy. He said the process is often long and frustrating, but that does not mean it should stop. Republican Representative for Illinois Adam Kinzinger said Trump should stop spreading debunked misinformation. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said there is no defense for Trump's post-election comments and urged him to respect the results. That's while two other Republican senators have supported the president. Ted Cruz said Pennsylvania's attorney general had ordered the vote counting to continue in Philadelphia until Joe Biden wins. Lindsey Graham also said Philadelphia elections are crooked. Meanwhile, supporters of President Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger Joe Biden have held a second day of protests in Philadelphia and other U.S. cities over the election vote count. Both groups appeared outside a vote counting center in Philadelphia on Thursday morning. A group of the president's supporters held Trump-Pence flags and signs saying vote stops on election day. Across the street, Biden supporters chanted count every vote. Later in the day, anti-Trump protests were also held in New York's Manhattan area. On Wednesday, a few demonstrations led to clashes and police made some arrests. The demonstrations were triggered in part by Trump's comments following election day. He demanded that vote counting stop and made claims about voter fraud. Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. gives us an update on the vote counting process in the United States.
This is where we're seeing some ideological differences here. Now, when Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, says that the Pennsylvania Election Board will continue to count votes until former Vice President Joe Biden wins, well, you know, there's a little bit of truth to that, but it's not because they are cheating. It's because of the fact that most of the votes that are coming in are typically going for the former vice president, because a lot of Democrats decided that they were not going to vote in person. They also decided that they did not want the current president to be their president anymore. So they already knew who they were going to vote for weeks ago. So they mailed in their votes. But because of rules, the votes couldn't be counted until the day of voting, until voting day. Well, if you have an overwhelming amount of votes being cast and they're breaking records and then you can't really count the votes until a specific day, it's almost impossible to count all of the votes within a certain amount of hours.
And political analyst Mark Weber says the presidential election revealed deep divisions within American society.
Well, Donald Trump's bizarre remarks should not come as any kind of surprise, because even before Election Day, he repeatedly said that the only way he could lose the election would be through fraud, voter fraud, deceit, and vote tampering. Remarks like that 20 or 30 years ago would have instantly earned the scorn and contempt of most Americans. But things have changed. In the years ahead, I think people will look back on this year's U.S. presidential election campaign as a milestone of American decline, as a landmark in the fall of America's stature in the world, and as a time when the confusion, the division, the incoherence of American society became glaringly obvious. I don't mean just today or just in the context of the election campaign, but over the whole range of this past year, we've seen such strife, such division across the board in American society. Even 4 years ago, the election of Donald Trump itself was a clear symptom of just how frustrated, how angry and distrustful Americans have become, not only of the country's political institutions, of leadership, but also of the mass media, of the educational system, and even of each other.
17 states across the U.S. have reported record daily increases of COVID-19 infections, as the country registers a record number of over 123,000 new cases. The number of hospitalized patients continued to rise for the 11th day in a row, reaching over 52,500. Furthermore, the country's average daily fatalities also rose to 850. Some cities and states have taken measures to curb the virus surge by imposing curfews or reducing gathering sizes. However, 17 out of 50 American states do not have mandatory mask rules. The pandemic has spread across the country but has affected the Midwest the worst. Illinois and Texas are the leading states in number of cases in the last 7 days. Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic is surging across Europe, with a number of countries reporting new highs in the number of infections and mortalities. Italy registered a record number of over 34,500 new cases, taking the total number of infections to nearly 825,000. It also reported nearly 450 new deaths, the highest since May. In France, the daily infections rose by a record number of more than 58,000 cases. The country has so far reported more than 1.6 million cases. Greece also reported the highest number of infections on Thursday, recording nearly 3,000 cases. In Sweden, authorities registered more than 4,000 new coronavirus cases, the highest since the start of the outbreak. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says an explosion of COVID-19 cases is seen in Europe, while mortality rates are also rising in the continent.
We do see an explosion, and in that sense, it takes only a couple of days to have in our European region an increase, for example, with 1 million cases. And we see little by little the mortality increasing as well.
The WHO's regional director for Europe warned that in only a couple of days, there will be an increase of 1 million cases in the continent. Hans Kluge also noted that the mortality rate is also rising, but at a slower pace. European governments have implemented strict lockdown measures to stem the second wave of the pandemic. On Thursday, the continent emerged as accounting for the largest number of infections in the world. Austrian authorities have admitted official errors leading up to the Monday terror attack. MPs are now asking the government why it failed to act after receiving information in July that the gunman had traveled to Slovakia in search of ammunition. Hermeleski reports.
Vienna pays tribute to the victims of Monday's terror attack carried out by a sympathizer of the Daesh terrorist group.
It's a really tense situation, something we never had before in Vienna. So Vienna was always a really secure place, and we felt really safe and protected. And suddenly, well, out of nowhere, this comes. I'm living nearby, and hearing this was really shocking.
As the nation tries to come to grips with the terrifying shooting, news has emerged of serious mishaps in the run-up to the crime. Austria's interior minister confirmed the country did have intelligence that the gunman had traveled to Slovakia in search of ammunition in July. Apparently, a crucial tip was not followed up. Karl Nehammer admitted to official errors.
Something obviously went wrong in our communications. An independent commission of inquiry has been set up.
In Parliament, his predecessor from the right-wing FPÖ party called for the minister's resignation. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has called for more decisive action at the EU level against what he termed political Islam. Earlier, he'd made it clear the attack should not be seen as a conflict between Christians and Muslims. Experts believe if the correct attributions are not made, it could trigger cultural wars in society.
If you define terrorism It's the use of force against civilians in order to create fear for political purposes. So that's terrorism. That doesn't have, this definition doesn't have much to do with religion. So it's not necessary to call it Islamic or Islamist terror.
The 20-year-old gunman, an Austrian with North Macedonian roots, had been released from prison in December. Apparently, he misled the government's so-called de-radicalization program. The main worry now is how Europe is going to deal with what experts describe as the growing threat of homegrown terrorism. Homolinski, Vienna.
The U.S. administration has reportedly notified Congress that it plans to sell sophisticated armed aerial drones to the United Arab Emirates. The sale includes 18 of such drones in a deal worth nearly $3 billion. That's according to Reuters, citing people briefed on the notification. Reuters says the notification is informal, and the State Department should later send a formal one to Congress. But before the department does that, its weapon sales can be reviewed by the Foreign Affairs Committees of the Senate and House. Both committees even have the ability to block the sales. Their members have previously criticized the UAE's role in civilian deaths in the Yemen war. Last week, the U.S. administration also notified Congress of a potential sale of F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. Meanwhile, two prominent human rights groups have condemned the confirmation that Formula One is to hold a race in Saudi Arabia next year. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have criticized the decision over the human rights situation in Saudi Arabia. Amnesty has described the country's rights record as heinous. Human Rights Watch said the next year event in Saudi Arabia is a blatant attempt at sports washing. HRW said that the event is part of a cynical strategy to distract from Saudi Arabia's human rights abuses. The kingdom has long been criticized for its rights record, including the detaining and torturing of human rights defenders as well as women's rights activists. Riyadh has defied calls by international rights bodies to improve the situation. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has criticized the West's hegemony, saying things are moving in a different direction.
I'm not predicting the end of the United States or the West, no. I'm saying the era of hegemony of the West is ended. The ideological hegemony is ended. The West can no longer pretend to teach the rest of the world how to preserve the rights of its citizens. And things are changing. Things are moving in different direction. That's why they resort to desperate measures.
As Zarif said, the U.S. is now resorting to desperate measures by applying sanctions illegally. He added that Washington, in fact, is punishing anyone who tries to observe Security Council Resolution 2231. Zarif stressed that the world would be a much better place if the United States changes its policy and approach. The Iranian foreign minister made the remarks in Caracas, where he praised the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, for resisting what he described as a U.S.-coordinated campaign to oust him. Yemeni students graduating from the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a have celebrated their graduation by paying tribute to the late top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq.
With the name of martyr Qasem Soleimani decorating the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Haj Qasem, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proof to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism reaching its peak.
Martyr Soleimani is a force in the region, and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the President of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as Ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The United Nations has slammed Israel for carrying out the largest demolition of Palestinian homes in years in the occupied West Bank. The UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said in a statement that so far in 2020, nearly 690 structures have been destroyed across the West Bank. On Tuesday, Israeli bulldozers razed an entire village in the Jordan Valley, leaving some 80 Palestinians homeless. According to the UN statement, this was the biggest demolition carried out by Israeli authorities since 2016. The UN called the move a grave breach of international law. Earlier, the EU called on Israel to cease demolishing Palestinians' homes in the West Bank. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the United States, the role of scientific research in public policy is clearly on the ballot in the 3rd of November presidential election. Some Republicans have sought to undermine the research showing human-caused climate change since long before Donald Trump was elected in 2016. But the sidelining of science-based recommendations in policy decisions has only accelerated since. Against the advice of researchers, Donald Trump announced plans in 2017 to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, an international accord to fight global warming. He claimed the pact would devastate the economy without providing much environmental benefit. His administration has since rolled back more than 100 environmental protections it deemed burdensome to industry, including those seeking to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Donald Trump has also appointed industry insiders, or climate change doubters, to key roles overseeing environmental regulation, and cut scientific advisory committees at federal agencies. The politicization of science has come into sharper focus this year amid the coronavirus pandemic, as President Donald Trump has ridiculed and ignored many research findings and recommendations from the administration's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. We now present you an article written jointly by Valerie Volkovici and Sharon Bernstein. The piece is titled, Make Science Great Again, U.S. Researchers Dream of Life After Trump. The article has been taken from the Reuters News Agency website. Please stay with us for more of Valerie Volkovici and Sharon Bernstein's article. From his laboratory in Toulouse, France, Benjamin Sanderson models the range of extreme risks to humans from climate change, research he hopes can inform policymakers planning for worsening wildfires and floods. It is the kind of work he once performed in the United States and hopes to again soon. Benjamin Sanderson is among dozens of US-based climate scientists who shifted their research to France, or sought refuge in academia or in left-leaning states like California after Republican President Donald Trump was elected in 2016. They worried his administration's distrust of science would impact their ability to finance and advance their work. Now, with the presidential election looming and Democrat Joe Biden ahead in the opinion polls and promising to prioritize the role of science in policymaking, some of these researchers hope for a return to the days when the United States was viewed as the purported best place to do their job. Benjamin Sanderson said Europeans claim climate science in their continent is not treated as a political topic, adding that he also would consider returning to the United States under an administration that valued scientific input. In the United States, the role of scientific research in public policy is clearly on the ballot in the 3rd of November presidential election. Some Republicans have sought to undermine the research showing human-caused climate change since long before Donald Trump was elected in 2016. But the sidelining of science-based recommendations in policy decisions has only accelerated since. Against the advice of researchers, Donald Trump announced plans in 2017 to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, an international accord to fight global warming. Trump claimed the pact would devastate the economy without providing much environmental benefit. His administration has since rolled back more than 100 environmental protections it deemed burdensome to industry, including those seeking to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Donald Trump has also appointed industry insiders on climate change or climate change doubters to key roles overseeing environmental regulation and cut scientific advisory committees at federal agencies. The politicization of science has come into sharper focus this year amid the coronavirus pandemic, as President Trump has ridiculed and ignored many research findings and recommendations from the administration's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. According to an August statement by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a nonprofit organization that advocates for scientific approaches to social and environmental problems, the U.S. administration has made a habit of ignoring, sidelining, and censoring scientific researchers. White House Office of Science and Technology Policy spokeswoman Jordan Hunter did not comment on the departure of scientists under Donald Trump or on the administration's handling of research on climate change and the pandemic. She claimed the administration was committed to ensuring the next great scientific breakthroughs happen in America, such as artificial intelligence and space exploration. Joe Biden, by contrast, has promised to fight climate change and to use scientific research and advice to tackle the pandemic. The Biden campaign said his transition team is already seeking input from informal advisors on how to rebuild and expand U.S. research. Transition spokesperson Cameron French said science will be at the heart of a possible Biden-Harris administration. The candidate's contrasting takes on the value of science may be best summed up by Donald Trump himself, who said at an 18th of October rally in Carson City, Nevada, "If you vote for Biden, he'll listen to the scientists. If I listen to scientists, we'd have a country in a massive depression instead of we're like a rocket ship." Biden replied the next day over Twitter, "For once, Donald Trump is correct. I will listen to scientists. Make the planet great again." In December 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron offered alarmed U.S. climate scientists multi-year grants to relocate and conduct climate research in France under his Make Our Planet Great Again program, a jab at Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan. The program came in response to Donald Trump's decision to begin withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. According to the French government, at least 32 scientists from across the globe took Emmanuel Macron's offer. About 18 of them had been working at U.S.-based institutions before they moved some or all of their research to France. Benjamin Sanderson had previously worked on projections for extreme weather related to climate change at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. He said he moved to the French city of Toulouse to escape the politics that has engulfed U.S. climate science. He said he worked primarily in the hope of informing policy, an endeavor that was no longer relevant under the Trump administration. Another scientist who went to France is Philip Schultz, a former postdoctoral researcher at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. Now he studies organic electronics and solar energy in Paris under the French program. He cited the Trump administration's climate skepticism as driving his change of job and country. Philip Schultz said, "I work in a field that is trying to combat climate change and enable an energy transition." While some U.S. scientists took up Emmanuel Macron's call to work in France, others fled jobs with the federal government for positions in academia or for left-leaning state governments such as California, which tried to recruit disgruntled researchers. Jared Blumenfeld, California's Secretary for Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, who ran the federal EPA's Pacific Southwest region from 2010 to 2016, said, "I feel they're like Russian dissidents during the USSR," adding, "they've been in exile in California." Blumenfeld said it will take decades to rebuild science from an onslaught of politics and superstition he believes began under the administration of Republican George W. Bush. He said California will not begrudge researchers who return to federal government jobs if Donald Trump loses the election. He said if they want to go back and continue to work and build up these battered institutions, Godspeed, adding, "we've been here to take them in from the storm." The U.S. government scientists and experts have found refuge in academia. Joel Clement, a former director of the Office of Policy Analysis at the U.S. Interior Department, left government in 2017 after being transferred from a position focused on climate change in the Arctic to the department's Office of Revenue. He now does research and teaches at the John F. Kennedy School of Public Policy at Harvard University. Joel Clement, who has been involved in conversations about restoring U.S. science with other experts informally advising the Biden team, said, "Any administration is going to have a long road to get this back on track." Dr. Ruth Edsel, Environmental Protection Agency's former head of children's health, is still working at the agency, though she says she has been sidelined from her specialty under President Donald Trump. A pediatrician with a focus on epidemiology and preventative medicine, Edsel was placed on administrative leave in 2018 after advocating more aggressive measures to prevent lead poisoning. She now works as a senior advisor in the Office of Water. Edsel said, "I don't have meaningful responsibility in Office of Water." She said she hopes in new administration she would let share her expertise. The Environmental Protection Agency declined to comment. The Biden campaign hopes scientists who left come back to work for the federal government. According to advisors who were not authorized to speak publicly, a campaign working group has been tossing around ideas for restoring scientific integrity on Zoom calls, including possibly creating a White House office focused on climate change, setting up nonpartisan oversight of federal scientific agencies, reappointing scientific advisory panels, and recruiting young scientists to federal jobs. Climate scientist Ben Katramani Balaji, who is working as a laureate in the French Make Our Planet Great Again program, but kept its affiliation with Princeton University in the United States, said such changes would be very welcome. Balaji said, at some point, science is going to be invited back to the table, adding, as a community, we need to be ready for when that happens. Moreover, from travel bans to human spaceflight to the coronavirus pandemic, U.S. President Donald Trump's policies and actions have changed science. Since he took office in January of 2017, Donald Trump has not made science a priority. He has proposed massive cuts to many science agencies and took 19 months to nominate a science advisor. But his policies and actions have had strong impact, many of them harmful, on researchers and issues relating to science. A travel ban. In just his second week as president, Donald Trump signed an order that prohibited people from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. The order sparked fear and confusion, including among researchers from those countries and their collaborators. After several legal challenges to various versions of this order, the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately upheld a more limited version of the ban. Science spending. The administration's first budget proposal for 2018 calls for slashing funding for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, the U.S. National Institute of Health, and several other scientific agencies. The U.S. Congress, which decides spending levels, largely ignores the proposals, but the administration's spending requests signal its priorities for science funding. In the same month, Donald Trump signed an executive order that aims to dismantle the climate policies of his predecessor, Barack Obama. The order directs the Environmental Protection Agency to repeal limits on carbon emissions from power plants. Moon plans. Donald Trump directs NASA to work on sending astronauts back to the moon, signaling a change in priorities for the agency. The administration later puts a 2024 deadline on this goal, which would be within Donald Trump's second term in office if he is re-elected. Data ban. Scott Pruitt, appointed by Donald Trump to the post of Environmental Protection Agency Administrator, proposed a rule that would prevent the agency from basing regulatory decisions on studies for which the underlying data is not publicly available, which includes many studies that rely on medical data, such as those on health impacts of pollutants. Nuclear withdrawal. Donald Trump announces that the United States will exit the nuclear agreement with Iran, a move criticized by many researchers. Delayed advice. Trump nominates meteorologist Kelvin Drogemeyer as his science advisor. The president took longer to appoint someone to this position than any other first-term president since at least 1976, when the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy was actually created. Industry tilt. The Environmental Protection Agency proposes changes to its process for evaluating chemicals that would put greater weight on industry-funded research. Advisors cancelled. U.S. researchers decry a decision by the Department of Defense to cancel its long-standing relationship with JASON, an independent group that provides technical advice to the government and includes many eminent scientists and academics. Sharpie Gate. President Donald Trump falsely claims that Alabama is likely to be hit harder than anticipated from an approaching hurricane, and his administration criticizes National Weather Service forecasters who contradicted the president. A government investigation later finds that the administration's actions could undercut public trust in Weather Service forecasts. Viral misinformation. Donald Trump tells the country not to worry about the coronavirus because it is mild and like a flu. However, in recorded interviews with journalist Bob Woodward that weren't released until September, Donald Trump admitted that the virus is far worse than the flu virus and that he intentionally played down the threat to avoid creating a panic. Blaming the World Health Organization. With the U.S. coronavirus death toll rapidly climbing, Donald Trump blames China and the World Health Organization, WHO, and vows to freeze U.S. funding to the agency. The president hypes chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine as treatments for COVID-19, despite questionable evidence that they help. Subsequent studies show no evidence that the drugs are effective against the disease. The Environmental Protection Agency proposes to maintain current standards for particulate air pollution, dismissing evidence from government scientists and outside researchers that strengthening those standards could save tens of thousands of lives each year. Vaccine race. Donald Trump announces Operation Warp Speed, aimed at producing a vaccine against the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 by the end of 2020. Donald Trump declares that the United States will withdraw from the World Health Organization, WHO. The CDC sidelined. The Trump administration transfers responsibility for collecting coronavirus data away from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, part of a series of steps that sidelined the agency with primary responsibility for preventing and responding to disease outbreak. Testing confusion. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, issues revised guidance suggesting that people without symptoms do not need to be tested for COVID-19, sparking anger and confusion among scientists and public health officials. Guideline reversal. The Center for Disease Control reverses the new testing guidance after reports that political appointees at its parent agency, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, had published them without proper scientific review. Donald Trump announces that a coronavirus vaccine will be ready by October, before Election Day on 3rd of November, prompting fears that the approval process could be influenced by politics.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
U.S. elections on the 3rd of November are keeping the whole world on tenterhooks as to whether Donald Trump will be re-elected as Republican president or whether, on the contrary, it will be the Democratic candidate Joe Biden who will win the election. But how could a second Trump term or a first Biden presidency affect the Middle East? Despite the obvious differences between Trump and Biden, there will be few foreign policy changes in the region. In matters of foreign policy, the reports of the Pentagon and the Council on Foreign Relations point out that the current and future challenges facing the U.S. and the region are to contain the Islamic Republic of Iran, to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, support the allies in the Persian Gulf and Egypt and Jordan, stabilize the situation in Libya and Iraq, and attempt to put an end to the alliances between Syria and Russia and Iran. Under this scenario, the next U.S. administration's prospects in the Middle East will be based on strengthening relations with Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt while maintaining a more combative position with Iran. Now, the current president has gone one step further and has even assured that he is not popular in the Pentagon. And this organization seeks only to be at war and be able to spend millions of dollars on arms purchases. For their part, the Pentagon's top officials considered that a precipitous departure of the troops could endanger, wait for it, peace in Iraq and Afghanistan. This might signal that the upcoming U.S. administration will advocate leaving what the Pentagon calls a residual force in Iraq and Afghanistan as a preventive measure against, wait for it again, terrorism. President Trump turned American foreign policy inside out to the benefit of some nations and dismay of others. Now, both groups are watching attentively to see which direction the U.S. goes next. However, West Asia is not holding its breath while the U.S. chooses its leader, simply because they've already been there and done that, and no good ever comes out of it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. On the eve of the 2020 U.S. presidential election, it remains to be seen whether the Middle East is going to be used to galvanize support for a conservative nationalist foreign policy. In 2016, for instance, Trump's campaign often invoked the Middle East as a region where the U.S. has needlessly squandered blood and treasure. Furthermore, in September 2015, Trump pledged to deport all Syrian refugees, most of whom are Muslim, from the United States. Whereas for his re-election campaign, a paradox seems to be unfolding, with Trump touting his successes in the region as a peace broker. To discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Patrick Henningsen, who is the founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you for being with us, Patrick. Now, for all its stated desire to disentangle itself from the Middle East or the region of West Asia, Washington has really a hard time letting go here. But Biden and Trump represent two markedly different futures for some of the region's political elites in West Asia, especially their leadership in the Israeli entity and in a clutch of oil-rich Arab monarchies. How do you think the results will affect the region of West Asia?
Well, I think on the surface, it might look like they will present two different possibilities, two different scenarios for the Middle East. But if you look at U.S. history, what you'll find is from administration to administration, there's an incredible level of continuity between administrations that might appear to be being from different parties, for instance, or different personalities, totally different, but really the underlying policy is very slow moving in the United States. In the current situation, looking at Syria, looking at Iraq, for instance, there's definitely a drift away from previous policies by the U.S., so they're moving out, essentially, in the larger scheme of things. So, you know, in terms of the Israeli issue, I don't see a massive difference that will happen between a Biden administration and the Trump administration. I think, who knows, the Biden administration could be more beholden to the Israeli lobby or as beholden as the Trump administration. I don't see any noises being made otherwise. Certainly there's some to be gained with some of these other issues at play, like the JCPOA, but I'm not convinced there's going to be a massive difference.
Well, a new U.S. administration could signal a dramatic reversal of Trump's old policies in the region, where it's believed that it would seek maybe to patch the damage that he caused with the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially with the nuclear JCPOA deal, and maybe cool the tensions down. But why should Iran trust any U.S. president if, let alone in 4 years from now, a new, Republican president could come to office and just revoke another agreement?
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head, Marwa. They shouldn't. And I think Iran has learned this lesson. The Islamic Republic of Iran has learned this lesson already. And I think they're moving ahead with their future, with their plans. They should be looking to China to be doing more economic and political deals with China. They should be looking to Russia. They should be looking to their near neighbors as well, looking to strengthen their relationship with Iraq, for instance. And who knows, down the road, there could be better relations between Iran and maybe even some of the Gulf states possibly down the road. So I think Iran had made its position known in the last 24 months that it is prepared to defend itself, it's prepared to wield its own influence within its sphere, within its regional sphere. So the United States knows this very well, and hence that's why you're seeing the U.S. drifting out of the Middle East. Trump has made this a big part of his campaign. We're pulling out, he said, multiple times. So if a Biden administration comes in, the Democrats favor proxy wars. They favor gray area subterfuge, whereas the Republicans like to do things kind of on top, over the table. So there's a different style in terms of intervention or flexing muscle internationally, but at the end of the day, the policy is very similar. And the overall trend to me seems the United States is withdrawing its forces, its heavy assets, its soldiers, for instance, from the region, because it's just, there's no appetite for it in America right now. Certainly for this election cycle, there isn't. But if Trump gets reelected, who knows, things could change in a year. But low oil prices, very important for this president. As far as the Biden administration goes, I see maybe more similar to an Obama administration or Hillary Clinton style approach.
Patrick, you also touched the main issue here, because the experience of West Asia with the different U.S. Administrations, that they are always hostile to the access of resistance nations. Their hostility is deep-rooted, and there will be no shift, basically, in U.S. foreign policy, especially for West Asia, which is basically aimed at harming civilians, whether through direct wars or through sanctions, which are equally as hostile as wars. However, do you think by continuing this Genghis-style foreign policy, the U.S. will actually be securing its own benefits in the region?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think things are changing. And the current economic situation in the world, the United States' economy is very fragile. They can't afford high oil prices. People are struggling. Businesses are struggling to make ends meet. So low fuel prices is a big feature in that right now. Certainly, a Democratic administration, they're looking for, to wean off of fossil fuels and to, move into the green economy. So the Green New Deal, that means a higher fuel prices, maybe a drop in demand in terms of oil and so forth. But, the U.S. is pretty energy independent at the moment. That could change. So the need to intervene and the need to micromanage every single aspect of the Middle East is no longer at the top of their priority list as it was maybe 10, 15 years ago. So things have changed in that respect. I think that's overall good news for the region, but there's still problems that exist. The Israeli lobby dictates a Biden-Harris administration. Kamala Harris is very much aligned with AIPAC. I think they would continue very similar policies to the Trump administration.
Well, one very critical foreign policy issue that has almost been entirely absent from the Biden-Trump debates is Iraq, and with it, the U.S. role in the entire rest of Asia. Now, the United States, maybe its place in the world has been greatly shaped, especially over the last 17 years, by its presence in Iraq. Do you think that maybe after this election with a new U.S. administration, the U.S. will actually rethink its illegal presence in Iraq?
Yes, I think that's already happening. I think that's already happening. It's a quagmire that there is really no long-term solution for the United States. I mean, they'll continue to have a presence there, possibly, but really, I think against the overall will of the people in Iraq. So they'll be meddling, certainly in Iraqi Kurdistan, for geostrategic reasons. I think overall, I don't see, at least in the near term, 5 or 10 years, I don't see a big future for the United States on any level in Iraq. And they know that it's only going to exacerbate and cause problems. And Iraq knows that they're not going to be able to stamp out terrorism and fight ISIS with the United States marshaling and micromanaging everything in their country. So they're much more effective. They've shown that. I think even people, realists in Washington, realize that the Iraqis, with the help of Iran, did a tremendous job in rooting ISIS out of the country, whereas the United States has always not been terribly effective in that respect.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for joining us to talk about what the U.S. election means for West Asia. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next for more about this matter. As the U.S. presidential election was approaching, President Donald Trump has been pressing more Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel. With the prospects for further normalization are expected to become more challenging next year. Future challenges facing the U.S. in the region, as per the Pentagon, are to further pressure Iran, attempt to stabilize the situation in Libya and Iraq, and attempt to put an end to the alliance between Syria and Russia and Iran. U.S. presidential elections fever in West Asia in this following report.
I kept my promise, recognized the true capital of Israel, and opened the American embassy in Jerusalem.
The term reckless is often used to describe Trump's actions in the Middle East. Notably, the execution of the leader of Iran's Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, brought extreme uncertainty and raised questions over the U.S.'s approach in an already unstable region. On combating Iran, the Trump administration's reckless approach undercut American influence in the region. Instead, the Trump administration chose to draw on its military primacy to remain as an inevitable actor in the Middle East. Furthermore, the emergent normalization between Arab states and Israel comes at a time when Iran is promoted as a greater threat, and the Palestinian cause isn't considered as much of a prerequisite for peace as it was in the past. Meanwhile, as several countries come to the aid of warring factions in Libya, Trump has found himself caught in the middle of a group of strongmen he's forged close ties with during his presidency, prompting him to stay out of the fray and let them fend for themselves, stepping back from any involvement in the country that the U.S. fully destroyed in 2011.